Nuclear wish list. It's early Xmas for the nukesters because, boy, they just slipped their dream legislative agenda past the Senate by placing it inside a must-pass firefighting bill. And Congress just nodded and went along with them. The list of what's wrong with this legislation will be covered in two separate features today. But to get a clear understanding of the core of what's wrong with it, I spoke with a genuine expert on the problems with nuclear energy and nuclear waste. And she tells us,
when in 1974, the Energy Reorganization Act created the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, it was precisely to have regulatory control over this commercial industry. And the Department of Energy was assigned to be the promotional agency. The Atomic Energy Commission was split into promoter, Department of Energy, regulator, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We already have DOE promoting nuclear power, nuclear waste, nuclear weapons all over the place. Now we've got the agency that was supposed to be the regulator now in a position of redefining its mission.
Well, when Diane DiRico, Radioactive Waste Project Director for Nuclear Information Resource Service, or NIRS, shares the full extent of what the ADVANCE Act is, what it does, and the problems we can already see it creating, you get a clear-eyed view of the latest batch of ugliness, keeping us in that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, as we kick off our 14th year of weekly programs, we talk with Diane DiRico of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, or NIRS, about the trickery required to pass the all-encompassing Let's Satisfy That Nuclear Wish List bill that just cleared the Senate after previously clearing the House. It is headed to President Biden for signature, which is pretty much guaranteed. It's early Xmas for the nuksters and radioactive coal in the stockings of everyone and everything else. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the nuclear hot seat hot story with Linda Pence Gunter, and more honest nuclear information than will be covered in the U.S. presidential debate on Thursday. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, June 25th, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. The ADVANCE Act will gut nuclear safety and keep the nuclear Navy happy. Hardly anyone on Capitol Hill opposed it. Here with our first feature dealing with it is Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Oh boy, where to begin? There seems to be a compunction on Capitol Hill and in the White House these days to do precisely the wrong thing about almost everything. Pipelines approved, endless wars funded, asylum seekers thwarted, the list goes on. The endless wars are essential, of course, because they are needed to feed the voracious and murderous greed of arms manufacturers, many of which also produce nuclear weapons. They carry some of the biggest money bags on Capitol Hill, and their puppets there are only too willing to reward them. And in our world of anti-nuclear activism, it's the insistence on funding and promoting nuclear power against all the empirical evidence that demonstrates this is the worst possible choice for climate mitigation, assuming we conduct a successful phase out of fossil fuels, which should be a given, but isn't necessarily. Campaigning against nuclear power can be dispiriting given what we're up against, and we've certainly had a bad few weeks. First, the ridiculously named Advanced Act was passed 88-2 in the US Senate, sending us not forward, but back into the deep recesses of the 20th century. The Advanced Act emasculates what's left of any safety oversight of the already lapdog US Nuclear Regulatory Commission, ensuring that regulations are lightened and the licensing process is sped up and, well, safety be damned. 88-4, 2 against. Yes, we have precisely two allies in the entire Senate, and their names are Ed Markey and Bernie Sanders. If you feel like thanking them, please do. In the House of Representatives, the same bill was shoehorned into something called a Bill to Amend the Federal Fire Prevention and Control Act of 1974. Helping firefighters, that's all good, right? Of course, absolutely. But this sly maneuvering meant the House quietly passed the Senate Advanced Act while appearing to support firefighters. An overwhelming 393 members of the House voted for it, almost evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. There was only one principled voice in all this, and it belonged to Rashida Tlaib, the congresswoman from Michigan, who voted present. She said, "I voted present in objection to this ridiculous decision to tie the reauthorization of vital firefighting programs for our communities together with poison pills that undermine nuclear safety and were strongly opposed by leading grassroots environmental organizations," she told the Hill newspaper in a written statement. And there you have the big difference in Tlaib, someone who actually listens to grassroots organizations instead of corporate lackeys. Go ahead and thank her too. Contrast her with the preposterous cheerleading statements made after the Senate passed the Advance Act. "A major victory for our climate and American energy security," crowed Senator Tom Carper. But Sheldon Whitehouse, another Democrat, had to go one better, calling it a win for the planet. He probably has to think big because he represents the smallest state in the country. That's Rhode Island for those listening overseas. The Advance Act was followed by the Department of Energy announcing it would donate $900 million of our money towards small modular reactor development. Cue Jennifer Granholm, the witless Secretary of Energy, who called that decision and nuclear power a key pillar of our nation's transition to a safe and secure energy future. What SMRs are actually the key to are the door of the nuclear weapons industry, and especially the nuclear navy, who can't live without the supply chain of technical know-how from the civil sector. On the positive side, despite the continued bluster about restarting the closed Palisades, Michigan nuclear reactor that was shut down almost 2 years ago, there is growing skepticism that this will be technically feasible, no matter how much money the state and federal government pour into trying, said retired nuclear safety engineer Dave Lockbaum when speaking with the Toledo Blade, and who worked for many years at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where his wry sense of humor became legendary. "Palisades has about the same chance of restarting as I do of winning the lottery, and I don't even buy lottery tickets." I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat, and that's this week's hot story.
We will have a more extensive examination of the so-called Advance Act, what it is and what it does, during this week's featured interview, coming up shortly. Here in the U.S., we've learned that radioactive materials from two nuclear energy program research facilities in Japan, run by the Japan Atomic Energy Agency, have arrived in the United States, bound for processing and disposal at the controversial White Mesa Uranium Mill near Bears Ears National Monument. According to shipping manifests, more than 250,000 pounds of radioactive materials arrived in the port of Everett, Washington on January 16, 2024. Bills of lading show the materials were shipped by the Japan Atomic Energy Agency and imported by Energy Fuels Resources, which owns and operates the White Mesa Uranium Mill, as well as Canyon Mine, aka Pinyon Plain Mine, a contested uranium mine near the Grand Canyon. The radioactive materials include uranium ore, ore samples, cores, test hole samples, spilled ore material, soil, rock, uranium-loaded resins, and associated filter bed sands that were used to treat water contaminated with uranium at Japan Atomic Energy Agency research sites. So in other words, they don't want this radioactive material, but hey, let's send it to the U.S. And we take it with no notice to the public that these dangerous materials were being trucked to the mill. Tribal members in White Mesa were not informed, either by the company or by Utah regulators. And this isn't the first time that Japan Atomic Energy Agency has shipped radioactive materials to the White Mesa Mill. But White Mesa Mill was designed and built to process uranium ore from rock mined across the American Southwest. It is licensed as a uranium mill, not as a radioactive waste disposal facility. But extracting small amounts of uranium from radioactive waste and then disposing of the remaining waste for a fee has proved profitable for the mill. And because the mill doesn't have to go through the arduous and expensive process of being licensed as a radioactive waste disposal facility, it can offer cheaper prices than facilities that were designed for this purpose. We will link to the full article on this by Tim Peterson of the GrandCanyonTrust.org. On June 23rd, the 92nd annual meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted a resolution entitled The Imperative of Dialogue in a Time of Acute Nuclear Dangers. Among other things, it highlights the increasing risks of nuclear war arising from the Russian invasion of Ukraine, condemns Russia's illegal war of aggression on Ukraine and its repeated nuclear threats, welcomes the declaration by G20 leaders at the Delhi summit that, quote, the threat or use of nuclear weapons is inadmissible, and calls upon the United States to, quote, negotiate a treaty among nuclear powers barring any country from being the first to use nuclear weapons against one another. In the nuclear industry's push to nuclearize anything they possibly can, the Palisades nuclear power plant in Van Buren County, Michigan, that was shut down in the spring of 2022, is now on track to reopen. And that's exactly what its new owner, the disgraced Holtec International, plans to do. A great deal of their motivation includes receiving a conditional commitment from the U.S. Department of Energy for a $1.52 billion with a B dollar loan, which Holtec has labeled transformational. This planned reopening of the aging, embrittled reactor is being fought against by the groups Don't Waste Michigan and Beyond Nuclear. Kevin Camps, radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, was a guest on Nuclear Hot Seat number 667 on March 30th, where he addressed the issues involved with this planned restart in great detail. And we will link to that episode on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 679. And in another push by the Nukesters, in Piketon, Ohio, plans are in place to build a new fuel processing facility on the bones of the old gaseous diffusion plants, which were shut down more than 20 years ago after 50 years of service and still have not been cleaned up. The site plans to produce high-assay, low-enriched uranium fuel, or HALEU, which is necessary to operate small modular nuclear reactors. The problem being, there are no small modular nuclear reactors. There are no approved designs for small modular nuclear reactors. They are a fiction and illusion and hallucination, but one that is gaining a tremendous amount of money and drive and forward motion for the nuclear industry. And people damaged by radioactive releases from the old facility still have received no satisfaction from the government. And on Navajo Nation, despite the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, RECA, expiring this month, there are still health needs among Native Americans, and a few regional facilities still offer free screenings through RECEP, the Radiation Exposure Screening Education Program. RECEP programs currently are in operation still at Tuba City Healthcare Corporation and some 300 miles away at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Though patients can no longer apply for RECA compensation, RECEP clinics could still theoretically screen them for illnesses linked to uranium mining and atomic testing. The suggestion is for those in the affected areas to get their screenings as soon as possible, before policy is possibly changed. Over to issues in Japan, where leaders of the Group of Seven major countries expressed support for Japan's release of tritium-contaminated radioactive water from the meltdown-stricken Fukushima nuclear power plant into the ocean. Although the country and Tokyo Electric Power Company, which owns the still devastated and deadly nuclear site, claims that tritium levels in seawater and fishery products monitored by them have been well below standards set by the state, the question then becomes, what are those standards? Are they legitimate? And do they possibly disguise the dangers? China has slammed the water release and banned imports of Japanese fishery products from immediately after the launch of the operation. It is the hope of this program that the G7 leaders of those major countries got to eat a lot of Fukushima-sourced sushi during their deliberations. In Miyagi Prefecture, 72 kilometers or 45 miles from Fukushima Daiichi, restart is planned for the nuclear reactor there, a boiling water model the same as those that melted down at Fukushima. Repairs by Tohoku Electric Power Company fell 8 years behind its initial schedule, and the total estimated cost of these safety measures is 710 billion yen, which is 4.5 billion with a B U.S. dollars. The earthquake caused the premises of the Anangawa nuclear power plant to sink by 1 meter, and a 13-meter-high tsunami also hit the plant. The underground area was flooded, and reactor coolant pumps were broken. More than 1,000 cracks were found in the number 2 reactor building. If Tohoku Electric restarts the reactor as planned, it would be the first boiling water-type reactor, the same as in Fukushima, to resume operations in Japan since the disaster. There is also a big push to restart the 7 nuclear reactors at Kashiwazaki Kariwa Nuclear Power Plant. Restarting idled reactors, let alone building new ones, is proving politically difficult in Japan. There is no projected date set for restart, in large measure because neither the government nor the company has yet to secure the local government's endorsement. Also, confidence in owner-operator TEPCO was undermined in 2007 when a magnitude 6.8 earthquake damaged KK, causing radioactive material to leak and leading into an investigation by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Thus far, no one is willing to set approval for a restart or a date. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat! Nuclear Hot Seat! Nuclear Hot Seat! None that's out a week!
Want a mixed metaphor? You can now drown your sorrows about nuclear by getting in line for the latest in craft sake brewed in Odaka Ward, Minamisoma City, Fukushima Prefecture. Yes, that's right, only 10 kilometers, 6 miles, from the still highly radioactive remains of 3 melted-down nuclear reactors, locally grown, purportedly organic rice and Fukushima water are used to brew a unique craft sake that, if you drink enough of it, will make you forget your nuclear concerns while possibly inflicting new ones. The craft sake brewery run by Mizuki Taisuke and her husband Sato has opened in Odaka Ward. Odaka was completely evacuated after the 2011 triple meltdown and only deemed a quote-unquote safe place to live in July of 2016. Now it's proving to be a real hotspot, possibly because not much else is open in that formerly bustling city of 3,800 people, marked down from a pre-Fukushima accident high of 13,000. Brewer Sato says, "I hope to be able to express this area's strong frontier spirit through my sake. In addition to Fukushima-grown rice and Fukushima-sourced water, the batches may include locally grown hops, herbs, flowers, even ingredients such as miso and cocoa. But not a word about the possible radiation content of each bottle or the flavor notes that cesium-137 or tritium may create." Best of luck to these Fukushima sake entrepreneurs and especially to their customers, because all of them are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
Internationally, NATO is in talks to put nuclear weapons on standby, That's the word from Jens Stoltenberg, Prime Minister of Norway and Secretary General of NATO. Stoltenberg said, NATO's aim is, of course, a world without nuclear weapons. But as long as nuclear weapons exist, we will remain a nuclear alliance, because a world where Russia, China, and North Korea have nuclear weapons and NATO does not is a more dangerous world, and said that nuclear weapons were NATO's, quote, ultimate security guarantee, end quote, and means to preserve peace. The need to be able to commit ultimate war in order to maintain peace is both stupefying and heartbreaking. Russia has launched joint nuclear drills with Belarus, designed to prepare their armed forces in tactical nuclear weapons. Russia has also deployed a submarine off Florida, the first deployment of a nuclear submarine to Cuba since the end of the Cold War. This move is seen as not only a message to the Biden administration of Moscow's displeasure with continued U.S. support for Ukraine, but also of its increasing ability to stalk U.S. coastlines with stealth submersibles, a growing concern for the U.S. military. And China has accused the U.S. of undermining nuclear disarmament and said that the country should reflect on its behavior regarding nonproliferation. The criticism by the Chinese embassy in the U.S. was in response to a senior White House aide saying that Washington may have to deploy more strategic nuclear weapons in the future to deter the threats of Russia, China, and other adversaries. China stated that the U.S., quote, clings to a first-use nuclear policy, devises nuclear deterrence strategies against others, and has invested heavily to upgrade its nuclear triad. It has withdrawn from treaties and organizations concerning arms control, enhanced the NATO nuclear alliance, and expanded cooperation with allies on advanced military technologies. All of which, unfortunately, is true. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, even after 13 years, Nuclear Hot Seat continues to grow. Every week, we provide you with the latest nuclear news, at least one interview with a genuine expert on nuclear issues, word on actions of frontline activists, upcoming events, and calls for action. In the past year, we've expanded to include other voices. Linda Penskunter of Beyond Nuclear continues with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story every week. Now, once a month, we feature John LaForge of NukeWatch with the NukeWatch Report, and Alistair Burnett of ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, with cutting-edge updates on progress being made on passage and implementation of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It's a way of regularly incorporating outside voices and international perspectives to enrich our understanding of what's going on with nukes worldwide. That's a lot for 678 one-hour episodes, and, you know, it's pretty much a one-woman show here. When I say we, it's really me. Booking interviews, editing them, collecting each week's news and compiling it into a script, recording, editing, posting to the website and social media, and doing it all over again the following week. Sound exhausting? I won't lie to you, it is. About the only thing that keeps me going some weeks is your support, be it Atta Girls of Acknowledgement or, and this is really important, donations to pay for the many services required to keep us up and running. So I invite you to celebrate the launch of Nuclear Hot Seat's 14th year by sending us a one-time donation of, say, $14, or anything else you can afford. You can also set up a recurring donation of any amount, as little as $5 a month. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. So go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button and follow the prompts, or you can send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Whatever you can do, thanks for helping us get this far, and stick with us because there's a lot more coming. Now, here's this week's featured interview. The Nukesters love their acronyms. That's where the first letter of each word spells out a separate word to convey their larger message. San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station became SONGS. And it sounded like, if you said you oppose SONGS, You were against music. Great subliminal linkage. And now there's the horrific backwards ADVANCE Act. ADVANCE being the acronym for Accelerating Deployment of Versatile Advanced Nuclear for Clean Energy. You gotta wonder how much was paid and to who and how long it took to come up with that misnomer for a dangerous backwards piece of legislation that unfortunately just passed the Senate in addition to earlier passage in the House. How bad is this Backwards ADVANCE Act and what can be done about it? To break down the story and its implications, I spoke with Diane DiRico. She is Radioactive Waste Project Director for Nuclear Information Resource Service, or NIRS. Her main area of expertise is radioactive waste and radiation issues. She has closely followed so-called low-level nuclear waste issues for decades, the national and international moves to deregulate nuclear waste that would allow for it to be made into everyday household items and be dumped as regular trash. Diane has been deeply involved with tracking and fighting the Backwards ADVANCE Act and was eager to share her insights with the Nuclear Hot Seat audience. We spoke on Monday, June 24th, 2024. Diane DiRico, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let's just start with some basics on this truly horrific story. What is the ADVANCE Act?
I call it the Nuclear ADVANCE Act, but it is called the ADVANCE Act. It is a bill that has passed both the U.S. House and Senate that reinvigorates the nuclear power programs in the United States.
What are the major points we need to be aware of in this bill?
The ADVANCE Act, S-870, is a large nuclear bill that was tacked on to a short must-pass fire funding bill. And the nuclear part, Division B, it promotes small modular reactors. We call them small modular, mythical, magical reactors because there aren't any, but SMRs and new nuclear, which is really hard because it's so expensive, slow, dangerous to get online. Anyway, it promotes new nuclear power. It promotes advanced fuel, which could include high assay low enriched uranium, which is uranium fuel that is concentrated in uranium-235 up to nearly bomb grade, nuclear weapons grade. Nuclear power reactors operate usually with fuel that's 5% uranium-235. Weapons need over 90%. This high assay low enriched uranium would be on the verge of high enriched at 19 to 20% uranium-235.
So that would mean that it was virtually weapons grade.
Most of the energy and work has been done to get it up to this 20%, 19.75 level. And it's fuel that is not used in any reactors in the United States. There aren't even any reactors that have been designed and approved that would use this fuel, but it is the dream of the industry and the nuclear power and weapons establishment to use this fuel on a regular basis in reactors, including small modular reactors. There are other types of fuel, many of which have been tried and failed in the past, but are being brought back as new. So what the ADVANCE Act does is it promotes more nuclear power, this more highly enriched fuel and other fuels. It allows for foreign ownership of U.S. nuclear reactors, which Congress has voted that down two or three times as a standalone bill. This is buried in this bill, foreign ownership of U.S. nuclear facilities. It encourages the export of nuclear materials and technology to other countries. So we're talking about taking on the verge of bomb grade fuel and exporting it around the world. And if the dream of so-called small modular reactors comes true, having a bunch of reactors all over the place, we'd have this fuel and hotter waste all over the country, following up on if this were to be implemented. The final thing that it does is to tell the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to focus its mission to promote rather than regulate nuclear power. And I have three things to say about that. One is after the Fukushima disaster that started back in 2011, it was determined by a report by the Japanese government that a major reason was the collusion between the industry and the so-called regulator. So what we're doing here is ignoring that lesson and promoting having our so-called regulator be even more promotional than it already is, potentially repeating the mistake that led to the Fukushima triple meltdown disaster. The second thing is that when in 1974, the Energy Reorganization Act created the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, it was precisely to have regulatory control over this commercial industry. And the Department of Energy was assigned to be the promotional agency. The Atomic Energy Commission was split into promoter, Department of Energy, regulator, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We already have DOE promoting nuclear power, nuclear waste, nuclear weapons all over the place. Now we've got the agency that was supposed to be the regulator now in a position of redefining its mission. The one silver lining or the one hopeful piece of this is that it does not change the Energy Reorganization Act or the Atomic Energy Act. It's asking the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to be more promotional to the extent that is allowed by those previous laws that set up the agency. So we'll see. We'll see what that process is for reestablishing its mission, what the NRC does, whether there'll be public comment or not. So we've got new nuclear power, more dangerous fuel, foreign ownership of reactors, exporting nuclear technology and materials around the world, and doing away to some extent what's left of the regulatory mission of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
It sounds like Merry Christmas for the nuclear industry. This is their wish list, because it sounds like it takes the blocks away from every bad impulse they have been acting on that we have been fighting against.
The part that makes me the most concerned is that we're talking about enriching the fuel, taking all the energy that it takes to concentrate the uranium-235 to, as you say, nearly bomb grade, and then using it in many different places in the country and promoting it in other countries. This is a setup for the plutonium economy. This is a setup for justifying a worse police state than we're already heading into already. If we have plutonium and fuel, the higher concentrated bomb grade uranium fuel moving around on the roads, rails, and waterways, it will justify a worse police state than we're already facing.
Let's unpack a little bit about foreign ownership and why that deserves to be contraindicated in any dealing with nuclear in this country.
The Atomic Energy Act and the entire history of the country, it's been required that the nuclear facilities be owned and operated by U.S. entities. Now, even when they expanded from being government-owned to trying to commercialize it, there was still a requirement that it be U.S. companies that have the controlling ownership. There were proposals for new reactors maybe 12, 15 years ago that would have been built in Maryland at Calvert Cliffs, Calvert Cliffs 3 reactor. There's two there now. Up at Nine Mile Point, there are three reactors there, so this would have been a fourth. And then one in Pennsylvania, Bell Bend, they were calling it. So these reactors were stopped because Electricity de France had 51% of the ownership. There was an effort made to get U.S. companies to buy up that 2% to get them down under controlling ownership. No U.S. companies wanted to invest. So the projects had to be canceled. Ever since then, the NRC and the nuclear industry have been trying to change the law so that controlling foreign ownership would be okay. And Congress voted that down two or three times already, but it was buried in this big Nuclear Advance Act.
The strategy of burying a 93-page pro-nuclear gift bag inside of a 3-page Necessary Firefighters Act is a particularly callous, heartless, and damning move, I believe, by the legislators and by the nuclear industry. They couldn't do that for RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, but they can do it for, hey, let's get more nukes going. What is the thinking behind that?
What happened is, this is an election year. Fires are beginning to rage across the country. This is a 2.5-3-page bill that would fund fire research and firefighters for 4 years. It was passed back in 2023 by the Senate and sent over to the House. S-870 was a 3-page fire bill that sat at the House for a long time. Meanwhile, the Senate Energy Committee passed S-1111, a nuclear wish list in the Senate. It only went through the committee. It did not go to the full Senate floor. On the House side, H.R. 6544 was a combination of a bunch of nuclear bills. Those were merged into this one big H.R. 6544, sponsored by Diana DeGette from Colorado and Duncan from South Carolina, Senator Manchin being one of the sponsors of S-1111 on the Senate side. So we had two different big 100-page nuclear bills in the House and the Senate that were different. The one in the House did pass the whole House. There was opposition to it, but it went through. So when the fire bill was sitting there, the nuclear forces joined together and merged secretly S-1111 and H.R. 6544 into what they then termed the Advance Act. And it was then attached to the fire bill. So S-870, which passed the Senate to fund firefighters in the Senate back in the 2023, went to the House. They appended it. It was basically hijacked by this nuclear bill. It got added on, and the Fire Bill Division 1, the Advance Act Division 2, became this S-870 that the House passed. So then it went back to the Senate, and the Senate, having already passed the fire bill, still facing re-election at a time when you have to fund firefighting in this country, passed it. And it was passed by enormous margins in both houses. The House passed it 393-13, and the Senate 88-2. Senators Markey and Sanders from Massachusetts and Vermont voted against it. There were 10 that did not vote, and there were 88 that voted for it. I believe that most of the members of Congress that voted for this either don't know or know and don't care about the amount of radioactivity and radiation exposure and contamination that would result if this is actually implemented. It is an enormous shift, but there's no money in this bill. However, there was money that was passed for existing and proposed new reactors in the two laws that passed in the 2022 timeframe, the Infrastructure and Investment Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act. Those two laws passed as part of fighting climate. And sadly, there's so much money for nuclear and carbon capture in those bills that it may be more than the amount that was actually allotted for really true answers, clean energy, wind and solar and efficiency and all of that.
How does this read in relation to the recently allowed to disappear Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, RECA?
What the Nuclear Advance Act does is to promote a whole new invigorated nuclear fuel chain, mining and milling and fuel fabrication and high concentration of uranium in the fuel, which makes hotter waste, hotter routine releases, more dangerous waste and so forth. So this is all part of the Advance Act, which Congress passed almost unanimously. In the meantime, from the first round of nuclear fuel chain, from the mining and milling and bomb blasting in Nevada and New Mexico and in other parts of the world, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which had been enacted in the 90s to help compensate people who were suffering from those exposures, expired June 10th, 2024. Congress has not renewed that act. The Senate has renewed it twice. It needs to be both renewed and expanded. RECA, Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, would provide compensation to people who were affected by U.S. nuclear activities in the creation of nuclear weapons and the bombing. I mean, they call it weapons testing, but it's actually weapons detonation. And people downwind and downstream are suffering and have been for decades. And this is only the moral responsible thing to do, is to help pay for people who are suffering from what our government did. And yet the House has refused to bring it to the floor, particularly the Speaker of the House, Johnson, Mike Johnson from Louisiana. But we've got Scalise from Louisiana. We've got others who could be pushing it. And while we're in the process of investing and building and redoing this whole mess, the people who are suffering from the first round have not been compensated. And it's immoral, it's unconscionable, and it's typical. The nuclear industry, I was at a nuclear so-called low-level waste meeting about 4 or 5 years ago, and the legislative person for the Nuclear Energy Institute spoke about their plans to meet with every member of Congress, every congressperson and every senator and their staffs. And we started looking at the funding, the amount of money that the nuclear power industry put into lobbying before those two bills, the IRA and the IIJA, passed in 2021 or two. And it was so clear that the campaign contributions and the lobbying led to the nuclear industry getting billions of dollars in subsidies and loan guarantees for existing and new reactors. Well, at the same time, we've got people who want even a small fraction of that to help pay for their travel to get medical treatment and being completely denied. So there's still a hope that the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act will be expanded and extended. There's still work on that, and it continues, but it's very frustrating.
Possible impact of this bill on the interim storage. Are there implications for that?
Right now, it is illegal to, and the Fifth Circuit of the federal court system ruled that consolidated interim storage, that is taking the high-level radioactive waste from around the country at reactors and bringing it to a centralized location for so-called interim storage, that is not permitted under the existing Nuclear Waste Policy Act. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission went ahead and licensed two consolidated interim storage facilities, one in Texas, one in New Mexico, with the hope of bringing this waste there. But it was overturned. Their licenses were overturned by the courts. Now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is appealing to the Supreme Court. What most parties agree is that because such facilities are not permitted by law, that it's time to change the law. The concern I have is that Congress has approved the expansion of the nuclear industry and could very likely move on to change the laws to allow these so-called interim storage sites. Now, the reason why that is a concern is that it's going to take at least 40 years to move the irradiated or spent fuel, as it's called, the high-level radioactive waste from nuclear power. It's sitting at every reactor site. We've got a little over 100 reactors on about 80 different locations in the country, and each of those has high-level waste and contaminated land. What this would do is to begin a major campaign of transporting that irradiated fuel from those sites to a centralized location or locations to be supposedly held until a permanent repository is available. And then it would once again go onto the roads, rails, and waterways to that permanent location. And we have concerns that have been expressed at the meetings of the National Nuclear, there's an oversight task force that has basically conceded that the technology for a permanent repository is still not there. So we don't have a permanent place for the high-level waste. Meanwhile, with the ADVANCE Act, we're giving the green light to making as much more of this as they can get away with. And the centralized storage concept would be dangerous for the fact that all of this material would be moving on the roads, rails, and waterways back and forth to the site, or that it would stay there once it got there as a de facto permanent site, which is not designed to isolate it for as long as it's hazardous. And it's going to stay hazardous, dangerously radioactive into the millions of years. Some of the radioactive elements in both low and high level waste have a half-life of into the millions of years. And you multiply that by 10 or 20 half-lives and you get hundreds of millions of years dangers from this fuel. Some of the radionuclides are shorter lasting, only maybe 300 years, but it's still... We've never really isolated waste for as long as it's hazardous, and these centralized storage sites would be additional. You never fully clean up the reactor sites. I do have to hand it, though, to, you know, the concern at reactors is they were never designed as permanent repositories either. Every reactor is a de facto nuclear waste site, and the dream of the people in those communities is to get it out of there, but it won't all be gone. And it will be a long process to get it to a temporary place. And it means that everywhere we travel, if you look at the maps, if Yucca Mountain were to have been opened, which fortunately it has been canceled, the Yucca Mountain site in Nevada is a failed high-level dump permanent repository effort. It would have taken about 40 years and the waste would have traveled through most of the continental United States. I think 34 states, maybe more than that, would have had significant numbers of nuclear shipments. Each of these containers has more cesium than was released from Chernobyl, more plutonium than was released in the Nagasaki, the plutonium bomb, in each container. So each container has enormous amounts of radioactivity and the transport dangers. All you need is one big bad release. We look at situations like the bridge that was hit in Baltimore and years back, a Baltimore tunnel fire. Imagine irradiated fuel or so-called spent fuel in those situations. The containers are so heavy that they wouldn't even really be able to get it up out of the Chesapeake Bay before the containers might start leaking. So the transport idea is very dangerous. Eventually, there will need to be movement of this fuel to a centralized permanent place. I mean, that's what the current law requires, but it doesn't have a mechanism to get there at this point.
I've often pointed out that by calling these sites interim storage, it implies it'll only be there for a short time and then it will move on to permanent. But there is no permanent except the illusion created by Yucca Mountain. So they really, semantically speaking, should not be able to get away with calling them interim because right now they're the destination. And while it might be illegal, we are seeing what can be done with the laws, with the manipulation. When you've got that much money for lobbying and supporting your guys and gals and not having that level of funding for the people who are opposing them, they're on the verge of getting absolutely everything they want or need to expand this into what could turn out for us to be a highly radioactive future.
That's true. But I do think that we've lost a lot in this recent legislation. But the reality is still that nuclear is not affordable. I mean, even with all of the subsidies and the government funding, the utilities are not really wanting to invest in new ones. I mean, they're fighting like heck to keep the old ones open in California and Michigan. But the renewable energy that came online in 2023 was more than the amount of nuclear that we already have in place in the United States. And the nuclear industry is fighting against solar and against, you know, the subsidies to homeowners to put solar on their roofs. I mean, the wind industry used to allow nuclear to be part of their team, but they kicked them out because they were actually fighting wind in some situations. And all of the above scenario really doesn't work. Nuclear makes climate worse. Don't say nuclear doesn't help. Nuclear makes it worse. It steals the resources that are needed for real solutions. And despite all of that, renewables and wind and solar and efficiency are increasing at a faster pace than nuclear. And I think that this can continue, but we're going to have to stay vigilant. We're going to have to keep fighting. I mean, it took me a couple of days to absorb what happened in the Congress, the 393 to 13 and 88 to 2, passing these horrible bills. And yet, we still have logic on our side, and we are the power, and we are going to have to prevent more nuclear and this high assay, low enriched uranium fuel from being generated and propelling us into a further arms race, further proliferation of nuclear power and weapons. There's a clear connection between them.
Is there anything else you would like to add at this time?
Well, I appreciate your focusing on the nuclear issue, on this issue, particularly this recent congressional bill that passed, and on the implications for the future. And I think although it is dismal and it is uphill, we've always had uphill battles, and we are going to just have to take this on. We also need to take on the greenwashing that's been going on, claiming that nuclear helps climate when in fact it makes it worse. I think that's a whole part of what we need to do is hone our messages better, find better ways to get the understanding out there that radiation is as much of a pollutant and a danger as carbon.
Well, we will certainly be doing our best here to get that message from you and other activists who are working on this and spread it as far and as wide as we possibly can. If people wish to find out more and either connect with you or with NEARS to get on board and do what they can to help, where do they go and what can they do?
Our website is NIRS. As in Sam, .org, Nuclear Information and Resource Service, so NIRS.org. And there's a little button at the top that says to take action, and you can click on that. You can also sign up for our alerts. We probably do one every week or two, a little more than that when there are crises happening. But we welcome people to join our alert list and to check on the alerts that have been done. Most of them are then posted. And the website, it's got the basics.
That's terrific. For now, I want to thank you for the prodigious work you have been doing on this and so many of the other nuclear issues, and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
You're very welcome.
That was Diane DiRigo, Radioactive Waste Project Director for Nuclear Information Resource Service, or NIRS. You can contact her at NIRS.org. That's NIRS.org. We'll also post links to some articles on this Backwards Advance Act, one of them by noted award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman. They will be up on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 679.
Activists, shout out.
Campaigners from Close Cappenhurst and radiation-free Lakeland are dealing with enormous problems of transport of radioactive waste through their communities by rail. Now, they have a new mascot to bring the reality of how bad this situation is down to a level that even a kindergartner could understand. It's Thomas the Stank Engine, a cartoon creation of Cumbrian campaigner Marianne Berkby of Radiation Free Lakeland. Martin Lowe of Close Cappenhurst, campaigning for the closure of the UK's uranium enrichment plant, said, "Thomas got his name because he hauls train wagons which contain very stinky, very dirty, and very nasty new killer, N-U-K-I-L-L-E-R, waste. This deadly stuff is traipsed around the country to Sellafield. And for those of you not familiar, Sellafield is the largest nuclear site in Europe and the most complicated nuclear site in the world. By its own admission, it is home to one of the largest inventories of untreated waste, including 140 tons of civil plutonium, the largest stockpile in the world. To put that into perspective, between 5 and 10 kilograms of plutonium is enough to make a nuclear weapon. So while campaigners may not have the funds available to the nuclear industry, it does have a witty and telling and very direct cartoon of a mascot. We will, of course, post it on nuclearhotseat.com, along with a link to the engine announcing Thomas's existence at a Direct Rail Services Open Day event on July 6th at Kingmore Depot in Carlisle, UK. And last week, Veterans for Peace presented a superb webinar on nuclear power and weapons in a time of rising tensions. Speakers included William Hartung of the Quincy Institute, Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, and Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group. If you missed the presentation, we've linked to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 679. We also list the participants and how you can get in contact with any of them. So it's well worth your time and attention. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, June 25th, 2024. Did you know that there is an easy way to guarantee that you won't miss the opportunity to listen to a single Nuclear Hot Seat? It's as easy as going to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, and look for that big yellow opt-in box. You really can't miss it. Simply put in your first name, an email address, click send, and every week you will get one, only one email, with a link to that week's episode and a short description of its contents. Or if you regularly glom on to podcasts and listen all the time, go to your favorite podcast service and find Nuclear Hot Seat, sign up for it that way. Either way, you will have cutting-edge nuclear information that's not duplicated by any other podcast or broadcast that I know of in the world. If you know of one, let me know, but I sure don't. And while you're at it, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And of course, remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really and always need your help. Anything at all is appreciated, and we're grateful for whatever you can do. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with the date that it's over, because once it starts, it is never over. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Thanks for being here. And remember, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.